Good afternoon, Your Holiness. We asked Diana Chapman to present very briefly some statistics about the occurrence and distribution of patterns of addiction in that we feel will prime what Mark Lewis is going to be presenting. So if you'd begin. Mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you. So I skipped over this little bit, and when we met at lunch, we felt it would be important just quickly to look at what we know about the extent of these problems statistically in the world, and I'll just very quickly. I think he's telling you you have it on upside down.
Otherwise, I oh yes,
His Holiness.
How's that?
Yes, now
it
very
works
good.
Better.
Very good, very good, very good, very good. That minute to give us the. That minute to give us the conquest.
No, that's all right.
As long as you're saying the way you're wearing it, it feels as if the sound is coming out of your eyes.
Well, that too. This makes it a lot easier. I was wondering why I couldn't hear myself.
Good.
So, Diane.
Good. Thank you for your technological intervention. So just a few statistics. These are mostly from government sources, including this National Institute on Drug Abuse that will be represented here, and also the United Nations. And just quickly, so when we think about addiction, at least in the West, we tend to think first about illicit drugs, the so-called hard drugs that we associate with the words drug abuse and the often menacing images that these words conjure up. And I don't have any slides. These are going to be for the next presentation, so I'm just going to say a few words. So, but if we look at... So if we look just at mortality data, people who die, it's actually the case that tobacco or nicotine dwarfs the other drugs, the other addictive drugs, in terms of death around the world. And the numbers for tobacco are absolutely astounding. So in the 20th century, tobacco caused, these are estimates, of course, but on the order of 100 million deaths in the 20th century. And if the current trends continue, tobacco use will cause up to a billion deaths in the 21st century. So we think about the 7 billion, 8 billion people on the planet, a billion people in that century dying of because of tobacco use. In 2011, tobacco deaths across the entire world reached 6 million in that one year, 6 million deaths. And that number is projected to grow by the year 2030 to 8 million. And more than 80% of those deaths will be in low and middle income nations. Now that's because, as my discipline, public health in the West, our campaigns to stigmatize smoking, to make it unattractive, unappealing, to educate people about the health damage of smoking, those efforts have been reasonably successful. It's been a great public health triumph in the West. But meanwhile, the tobacco industry, the global industry, has imported this epidemic through aggressive marketing and advertising to the less affluent parts of the world. So that's, I think the word evil is not too strong a word for that. Every 6 seconds, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, someone dies of a tobacco-related death. Tobacco accounts for a full 1 in 10 of all adult deaths. Up to half of current tobacco users will eventually die of a tobacco-related disease. So in terms of preventable death and disease around the world, tobacco is the addictive substance that does the most harm. Public health enemy number one, we like to say in my field. But then, as I said, death and disease are only two markers of damage and of suffering, and they're the easiest to measure. We have the data, they're collected in hospitals and so on. And so those are the statistics we tend to collect and to focus on. And when we consider the pain and the despair that reverberate through families and through relationships and societies, the impact of alcohol and other drug abuse is huge. So alcohol abuse, and part of the distinction, of course, is alcohol and other drugs create these behavioral impairments that Richie spoke of. Tobacco, not so much. Tobacco destroys the body, but doesn't create the dysfunctional behavior that reverberates in people's families and lives. But it is addictive in many of the same ways. So alcohol abuse accounts for something like 2.5 million deaths a year in the world, around the world. And among younger people, those young people we talked about, but in this case between age 15 and 29, it's over 300,000 deaths a year, which is a full 9% of their deaths. So it's one of the most important causes of death in that age group. Alcohol plays many roles in social life in many cultures. It's believed among the substances that we humans have used to change our mood and change our perception, alcohol is believed to be the one that has been used by more of the Earth's people in more places and times than any other. When we make comparisons across countries of the impact of alcohol and its abuse, we find that the central role that's played by cultural factors, not only in the way alcohol is used and regulated, but also in the very definitions of the nature and extent and source of the problem. And you saw from Richie's slides some ways to define these problems. So that makes it difficult to compare the statistics across countries, but we are getting better at that. Next, after alcohol, we wanted to mention drugs. Illicit drugs, illicit drug use globally accounts for somewhere between 90,000 and 250,000 deaths every year in the world. And those are mostly premature and they're mostly preventable. And they're from causes such as unintentional overdose, taking too much of the drug, not intentionally, but enough to die from doing that. Suicide, so intentionally, right? HIV and AIDS, as you know, I'm sure, acquired in part through contaminated needles, but also through sexual practices in drug subcultures that expose people to those viruses. And then trauma, especially motor vehicle accidents. So in 2010, the UN estimated that some 150 million to 300 million people worldwide had used an illicit substance at least once that year, and between 15 and 40 million were problem drug users. Now, those estimates have quite wide ranges. If you think 150 million to 300, 15 to 40 million, that's a wider range than one would like in terms of precision. And that's because it's difficult to obtain these data. So we don't know quite as much about these problems as we would like to. But there is absolutely no doubt that drug abuse exacts an enormous toll. And we will be discussing that impact, as we say, from many angles. So that's, I think, a good sort of beginning for our session this afternoon. And I just wanted to make sure we had some sense of the magnitude of the problem before we went on. Okay. Now how do I get it off?
Thank you, Diana.
Diana Eichel.
So, Your Holiness, clearly the extent of suffering caused by addiction is vast to consider. And then the lesser aspects of the continuum of craving have profound impacts environmentally, socially, psychologically, which we'll touch into. Our next presenter is Dr. Mark Lewis, who is a neuroscientist, but also is someone who has been through the journey of addiction. And as you recall, Francisco was always emphasizing the importance of being inside the experience, the first-person experience. So Mark, who's written a best-selling book called The Addicted Brain.
Memoirs of an Addicted Brain.
Memoirs of an Addicted Brain. is going to be exploring with us this afternoon, and then I hope we can open the discussion to our entire group and with you. Profiles of addiction, and also an exploration, you know, how addiction builds upon itself, the nature of recursiveness in the addiction cycle, and also possibilities for transforming the experience of addiction. And our work right now in Mind and Life is this very important threshold where we're moving from pure research, which some of which Mark will speak about today, into the application of this research into transforming suffering. So Mark, please.
Hello. It's very good to meet you. And thank you for inviting me, everyone. It's a pleasure and honor to be here. This is not actually my presentation for today, but I wanted to show you some pictures because I thought that would help bring it home.
Go down.
Yeah, I do. Okay, we're there. Yeah, so these are pictures that I've gotten from the web in different places of addicts, different kinds of addicts to drugs or drink or sex addicts or food addicts. Okay, it just gives you a feeling of how much these people are suffering. I'll just go through them. A drinker, some smoking crack. Someone sentencing someone to prison for taking drugs, probably. A drinker. Someone shooting heroin or shooting cocaine or methamphetamine. Someone who has used methamphetamine for a long time. She's probably in her early 20s. This is what she's looking like. Amphetamine speed.
Speed.
Someone who's high on speed or on something. This is the look of the addict who's looking for drugs. Gambling addiction. Gambling and alcohol go together quite well. Food addiction. Yeah, it's really crazy images. Sex addiction. It's a serious problem for some people. It's a serious problem for him. Food. Anorexia. So she also eating problem.
Mark, you want to explain anorexia?
Yeah, anorexia, someone who starves themselves. They make themselves starving because they're afraid to look fat. And when they look in the mirror, they think they look too fat, but really, they look like skeletons. And people can die from it. And these are people who have probably taken heroin or something, and now they're almost unconscious, or they are unconscious, one of them is. So another picture of someone who's used probably speed for a few years. So that's a serious, some of the faces that go with it. Escape? Well. Okay, so. Is this mine? No, where's mine? There it is. Yeah? Yeah. Okay, my talk. So, three main points. The first one, addiction works through repeating cycles in the mind and in the brain. I talk about it in the mind and then in the brain. You asked about the causal arrow and I want to get to that. But the first causal arrow is a circle. Okay, second point is the central role of craving in addiction and how the importance in Buddhism also, and trying to make some beginning connection between craving and addiction and what craving means in Buddhism in terms of suffering.
Seva.
Seva.
And about how it relies on the neurochemistry of dopamine, which is this neurochemical that Ritchie...
Craving sadi. Touch the emotion you have to do. She double, but the champagne double says,
Okay, so more about craving and the neurochemistry of it, a little bit. And then last, to overcome craving, addicts have to learn to trust themselves.
Ms. Solinus was asking the question that the English word craving, does it have a connotation by its very nature, something that is destructive, something that is negative, or can craving be in the context of a more positive object?
Yeah, well...
pursuits.
You know, I happen to have this book in my briefcase, so I thought I would show it to you. Mm. It's called Drinking, A Love Story. It's a very good book written by an alcoholic. The point is, a love story. So this is one way to think about addiction, that it has some common elements with falling in love and being in love. Well, if you crave the person you love, maybe that's not such a bad thing. Mm. But...
Because some cases, is a person who often lose temper, at once they got wine, then become very peaceful.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, but generally, yes, craving is a bad thing. Craving usually means strong desire for something that you don't have it right in front of you. It's not there. You have to get it, and you're going to really work hard to get it and do something serious to get it. Okay. So I'm going to start by talking a little bit about what it was like for me to be a drug addict. Mm-hmm. So this was in my late 20s, from 25 to 30 or so. So a typical day might be I was going to school, graduate school at that time in psychology, but during the day, thoughts about drugs would increase and increase, get stronger, and I'd try to make them go away. I better not do that. I said I wouldn't do that anymore, or at least not this week, or not before the weekend. But thinking about it more and more and starting to feel more excited about it. And then there's some snap where all your good judgment goes and you say, just to hell with it, I'm going to do it. And then after you're finished whatever you have to do, I would go out and buy some plastic from a hardware store, which I could use to open locks. In addiction, you always have to do something to get it. Like you have to buy it on the street or find someone to sell it or do something dangerous. Well, with alcohol, you could just buy it at the store, but if you don't have any money, that's a problem. But so then I would maybe get this thing and then go to a doctor's office. I wait till 5:30, 6 o'clock, till all the doctors and nurses leave, and then I go in with my piece of plastic, go in and open up the door. And by this time, I'm very excited. And this excitement, this anticipation is absolutely a really important part of it. It's all you can think about. And you can't stop then. It's extremely difficult to stop once you've reached that point in the cycle. Okay? Okay, so, and then I would, you know, go and I would feel very hopeful, excited, hoping I would find something, a drug that I like, opiates for me, hoping that I wouldn't get caught, and all these things. But you're really going 300 kilometers an hour in your mind at this point. It's a different kind of consciousness, really.
What's the mutual world? shiva seven is just what about that?
Kalo.
Drag the same is that the shiva seven is just
shiva. Mar that na kuran the drag manya konse kore.
Ale.
The double shiva just seven shuk shu mulai ne ta ko ko shu du gyo ro ta.
Ale.
Du du ji ga la lo chung bu je. Ani. Tu kon te ta na ke kuran te shu tu.
Oh.
Okay. So then I guess I would find stuff, or I wouldn't, but usually I would. And then I would maybe go to some place where I could take the drug by mouth or sometimes shooting it, injecting. And then maybe I would be afraid to go home because I had a wife. I don't have the same wife now. But then I might go somewhere else and just stay somewhere for 3 or 4 hours and just feel some peace and some relief, maybe even do some work, maybe do some, write an essay, but feeling much more relaxed. So that's maybe a typical cycle.
Hmm?
Okay. And such a comparison of Sinjan, Susu, Laja, the Chiyong Totus.
So that means your wife not supportive.
No.
About your.
No.
Well, that's good. Good teacher.
Well, she took these things a few times, but she didn't like them nearly as much as I did. I really liked them. But she was unpleasant in other ways.
Onward.
But these problems usually join together, right? So for me, over the period of maybe 3, 4, 5 years, I tried to quit probably 200 times, approximately. Sometimes I could quit for stop for good. Sometimes it would last for a week, sometimes a few days, sometimes a few weeks, sometimes a few months. But the most serious part of addiction is not the physical part, but it's the psychological part, since you go back again and again.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm most interested in scientifically.
Okay. So continue.
Okay. I want to mention one more thing. Richie was saying stuff about the personality characteristics like poor self-control in children, and maybe that's a genetic factor, and it is partly responsible for addiction. But you said what about environmental impact? I think that's extremely important. 90% of the addicts that I talk to, and I talk to a lot of them, it's environment. And for me it was environment. Okay, so when I was a kid, I could eat half a chocolate bar and put the other half away. So I would do well in the marshmallow test. But my parents sent me away to school, and I was very depressed. And why did you send me away? You know, am I bad? And after I came out of that school, I was really messed up. Okay, so then, and then I was in California, and it was 1968. And the rest is in my book. Okay. So yeah, environment, how important that is. Oh, I wanted to tell you one more thing. This famous experiment, which I think really captures this, it's called Rat Park, done around 1990 by Bruce Alexander. And what he did, he found normal rats in the laboratory put in normal steel cages, one to a cage. If you give them a bottle of water and a bottle of morphine solution, they take more morphine and they get addicted. Okay? Typical, everybody knows, you know, if you have morphine around, you drink, you get addicted, right? Except he would take these rats and put them in a special cage where there were several of them together so they could socialize. And they had toys to play with, rat toys, and wood shavings and stuff to do. They weren't bored. And they stopped drinking the morphine and started drinking the water instead, even if they were addicted. So they would spontaneously stop being addicted just because they were in a different environment and because they had each other.
Okay. That's some thing you told us.
No. So it really has a relevance to whether they were happy or not. Yeah.
Exactly.
Social.
Yeah. So the social world is very important. I mean, imagine being in a cage alone all day. What else are you going to do? Okay. So anyway, 30 years later, I wrote this book, Memoirs of an Addicted Brain. I wanted to put together my experience of being an addict with the neuroscience of addiction. So I studied neuroscience of addiction for several years and wrote this book, putting together the feelings of it with the science, the neuroscience, especially different drugs, different brain effects, but especially addiction in general. It doesn't matter which drug, or whether alcohol or something else, there are certain brain processes that are exactly the same. So I put that in my book. Okay, and that's what brought me here, I think, today. Okay, so now, here's how it works. Here's a simple cartoon of a feedback cycle, a simple cycle, that goes from drug imagery, thoughts and imagining about the drug, what it will feel like, what it looks like, what it tastes like, blah, blah, blah.
It's amazing.
To craving, more images, more craving. Yeah? Okay, round and round, gets stronger and stronger. And then, oops, didn't want to go there. Yeah, there. Then comes doing. So finally, it leads to action. You go and you get the drug or the drink or sex or whatever it is. And that is further strengthening the loop of causation. Okay? So now we take this same cycle and we look at it in brain terms. Start with a trigger. The trigger, it can be something you see, like there's a pipe for smoking some drug. Or it can be a memory. It could be somebody's phone number that you see. Oh, I can call this guy Joe and get my drugs. Or it could just be a memory. It can be a feeling in your stomach. It could be anything. Anything can trigger the process. That trigger is perceived. So you have perception in the back half of the brain, in the posterior cortex. Images. Images. And, of course, the images are better than, well, you know, they're optimal. Oh, it's going to feel really good, and I'm going to feel very high and special, et cetera, et cetera. And those, why do I do that? Those.
It's another good, that, because of happy, you do that, because rich, any drugs, you know, basically, you know, 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 you That you can assume what
it. Holiness has heard from people that some people, when they use substances, you know, certain types of drugs, it leads to some kind of spiritual type kind of euphoric experience. So His Holiness is wondering, where is that coming from?
I put that in a different classification. Some drugs are mostly harmful, but some drugs, like psychedelic drugs, LSD, mescaline...
Mm-hmm. LSD, you said.
No, he's only just heard with respect to LSD.
They have been used for learning about, for feeling connected to the world, for seeing the world in a different way, experimenting with your own perception. And in some cases, I think it can be positive. It can give you a different insight.
Because of Trinaria.
But so there is still a kind of a delusory aspect to the experience.
Probably, or maybe this is all delusion and that one's real.
That's of course different level.
So we're speaking at the conventional level.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Fine. Yes, the world changes shape and color and substance. Thinking changes, but you know the famous people Baba Ram Dass, Richard Alpert, and Aldous Huxley, and these famous philosophers have used psychedelic drugs, maybe for positive. But this is not the case for heroin or speed. There's really nothing positive.
In Tibetan, we call it yabing or nyetak. Is it opium? Yeah, it's opium.
Opium.
So which category would the opium fall on? It's not in the psychedelic.
No.
So it'll be more in this. Yeah, okay.
Opium is what heroin comes from.
Yeah, that's
morphine and heroin come from opium. It's the same type of effect on the mind. It's calming, soothing, warm, safe, feel relaxed. Now, if people do that now and then, the way some people have a social drink, probably okay. But it can be addictive, and often it is.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, it's used to as a painkiller, but it, it you know, it becomes a mental painkiller, and then it begins to cause the pain that, it, as Mark will explain, it becomes the source of suffering, not the ending of suffering.
Yeah, that's an important idea. Because people will often take these things for relieving psychological pain, like we talked about. But once you are addicted, then the most of the stress becomes, I really need to get some more. I'm such a terrible person because of this, and I hate myself. Now the stress is coming from the drug. But it still gets relieved by the drug, but it's also coming from the drug, round and round. Okay, so back to the brain. So now we're in the imagining phase, and the imagining is bringing dopamine up from the midbrain up to the striatum. This is what Richie talked about as the reward center. One of the things it does is it produces craving, desire, attraction, right, motivation. I want it. And it also changes attention. So attention gets very much focused, narrow, focused like that. You don't think about much else, only the thing that you want. And then there's a feedback cycle right there. Different brain parts send messages back to the midbrain, say more dopamine. Then you get more dopamine to the striatum, and the craving is intensified And now you're planning, you're thinking about how am I going to do it, where am I going to get it, who will I call, where do I get some money, planning. That leads to more imagining, back and forth, more craving. And finally, there's the information goes up to the motor cortex, of course, the motor brain, and now it comes to action. And the action is to get the drug. So that's the cycle.
So earlier in Richie's presentation, he talked about the role of delusion in this kind of cycle. So where would that fit in?
I'm going to show you exactly where it fits in. Yeah, I'm going to get to that. Okay, so here's another way to look at the same cycle, psychologically, the psychological elements. First comes the trigger or cue, then comes craving, then comes imagining, and there's a cycle there, intensification, more intensification, round and round. Okay?
But earlier you had imagining before the craving.
They come together.
Yeah.
They really do.
Together.
I mean, You Buddhists know this better than we do, that thought and emotion always come together, right? So
the common sense between imagination.
So even from a commonsensical point of view, without this kind of element of imagining or fantasizing, the craving may not arise.
Without the
imagining or fantasizing, the craving may not arise.
But first comes the trigger, which could be a stimulus.
Sure.
It could be a smell. It could be anything. Sure. That can already start off the craving. Kent will be talking about that tomorrow, I think. The desire wanting system.
Yeah. Okay. That's also one way to explain. Yes, okay.
It takes very little to trigger this the cycle. And then imagining is part of the growth of the cycle.
Good.
It's like priming a pump.
Yeah. Okay, so there's that cycle, and then comes finally doing the act, and then That leads to relief, first of all, right? Relief feels good, which leads to learning reinforcement, just positive reinforcement or negative reinforcement. And then comes loss, because it only lasts for a few hours, right? So then you're empty and lost, and you feel empty, and so then you want to do it again. And that's how the cycle repeats itself. Now we have the cycle that's repeating itself over time. And if you look at that across the weeks and the months of a person's life, it gets, as it keeps repeating, it's changing the brain, and Nora will talk about that, and Kent will talk about that. It's changing the brain, changing the synaptic configurations in these areas so that you become more and more attached to this particular drug or drink or sex or gambling, whatever it is. Okay, and we can call that development. It's the development of a habit. It's a bad habit, but it is development. And we could also call it sensitization, because you become more and more tuned into that thing, that one thing. Okay? Okay, now, for something completely different, the Buddhist perspective about existence and suffering, and I think there are some connections that we might want to think about. So in Buddhism, the little bit that I understand, there are factors, maybe 12 factors, that that interact in time, and they result in cycles of suffering or cycles of existence. So choosing only 5 of these factors that are important for this, we could say that suffering arises from contact, experience... And craving is the big one that we can all agree is very important, and grasping, and especially the connection between craving and grasping, so important. And then becoming. Okay, so if we look at this in manifestations in addiction, how would we make a translation to the elements in addiction? Well, contact is the trigger, the cues or the thoughts, the stimulus, right, the perception. Then comes the experience, which is could be pleasure or relief. The experience of the drug or
actually the classical model of the wheel of life, the contact is really in relation to the arising of a perceptions. So when the sensory organ and the external object come into contact. That's what it is being referred to. Mm-hmm.
But could this be when your eye lands on a pipe?
Yeah.
You say,
oh.
No.
Okay.
No, physical contact.
Okay.
Okay. Craving is craving. We know what that is. Pure desire that for something that you can't have, maybe, or hard to find. Grasping, and then this is the planning and the getting of the drink or the drug or the sex or the gambling. This is the action. And then the becoming, I'm not sure what to say exactly, but we could say increasing dependence. So the cycle goes on to the next, increasing connection to the drug or the activity. Okay. And now I want to talk more about craving, specifically. Craving is the one condition that all addicts agree is their worst enemy. And I talk to many addicts on my blog, and it's always, that's the worst part, okay? This is, believe me, 99%, that's the worst part. How do you escape from craving? And neuroscience helps us understand why craving is so difficult to escape from, why it's so nasty, why it's so powerful. So these are the four major neuromodulators. They come up from below the cortex, and they come up into the cortex and limbic system, and they things like serotonin and dopamine, and they affect. They have global effects, so they affect not only a few cells, but huge numbers of cells at the same time.
And the one. Excuse me,
so there are four different colors. You want to explain them?
Yeah, I think, you know, I just want to say there's a bunch of them, but we're going to focus on dopamine. That's just one of them.
Chemical kakarishatan. Dopamine chet, serotonin chet. So tanukuran dopamine kante tishingisala.
I just want to show how complicated it is. So here's dopamine, and it's a neuromodulator that's job is to get us to go after goals, right? And pursuing goals. And it mostly goes to the striatum, which we talked about, that reward part, and also to the prefrontal cortex, like Richie talked about, where it's just in charge of some cognitive planning. Okay, now. So, what does dopamine actually do? Well, it focuses attention on the immediate goal. Like I said, it narrows attention. Okay, it narrows attention, and it also generates desire or craving at the same time. These two things go together: narrow attention, more attraction, you know, like a funnel. Craving traps you in this moment of anticipation for the thing that is in your attention. So what is it like to be in a state of craving? Well, it's not just a steady state. It's not just stable. Rather, it goes up in time. Because of the dopamine pump, it goes up. Okay, it rises in time. It gets stronger and stronger by the moment. As the reward gets closer in time. So as you get closer, you know that 7 o'clock you're going to have a drink, then at 6:30 it's going up. 6:45 it's higher. It goes up like that. Okay. Okay. So here's an example where we have in this graph intensity of desire is on the y-axis, and this is time, could be hours, on the x-axis. And here's two rewards: one is a drug, and one is a happy girlfriend or a happy wife. Right? If you take the drug, you probably won't have a happy wife. Right?
That's just a.
The drug she would be a happy wife the only yomaris.
Correct.
Drug she would do na and happy wife the only yomaris. That I'm going to check out.
Okay, so we can see that the happy girlfriend is worth more than the drug, but the problem is that for the addict, as the addict is this is the dopamine rising to this reward, to the drug, and it goes above the line of desire, or that's leading to the happy wife. So the happy wife goes down in value, and the drug goes up in value, just because it's closer in time.
And sex addict, you marry,
so what about
because a girlfriend, you marry.
So what about how would that translate in the case of a sex addict?
good question. Well,
go for it, Mark.
Am I supposed to answer that? I guess if the person you're having sex with is your wife and it makes her happy too, then it's just one curve.
Yeah. Sex addict na mangbo chiyan susurang kasanta mayin bo chinda le nyambo.
Ah yes, sexual misconduct.
So there will be a lot of
usually it's
infidelities.
Yes, usually it's probably not your girlfriend or your wife, it's somebody else.
And then as you mentioned, the animal, the mice, under the kasa chukti addict chigwa.
Opiate, yeah.
Oh, sex addict ayuna animal ya.
So you mentioned about rats getting addicted to, was it opiate? Yeah,
opiate, yeah. Morphine.
And some wines, I think.
And alcohol, possibly.
They can, yes.
Oh.
But what about sex addicts in
animal? I don't think.
Rabbits.
Rabbits.
That's just because of that. I mean, just as a focus of the time for reproduction. And then come. Otherwise,
Don't look at me. I think we ought to get back to opiates and off of sex as the moderator.
That's
a request.
Okay.
So he sort of, his point is that probably in the animal realm, the reason why there probably one cannot talk about sex addicts is because sex is more in the context of a reproduction.
Uh-huh. Or not. But some kinds of monkeys, they just...
biological factor. And nature. Without sex, no reproduction. So that's originally like that. The biologically go like that. So I think certain time, I think sometimes discipline animal better than human being. I think they just go, is it they?
According to the natural pattern.
Whole years of the Torah. Even those birds, when...
also, there's a cycle of time, yeah.
When worms, insects available, then the chick...
they lay the chicks, yeah.
Oh. Then other animal, autumn, when they are milk, you see, physical, more stronger, milk available, then give birth.
So they adapt more to the environment.
So I felt that's because of the animal, because of the sex addict. Are you not something?
So Solinus is wondering whether sex addict, the concept would make sense in the case of animals.
Yeah, there are some monkeys. Bonobos are famous for this, for having a lot of sex. But maybe it's serving another function because it's a way to make friends.
That also, I think, the more so strong body, male usually, you see, a strong body, and then usually the leader. Of the herd, group.
The group.
So you see, he have a lot of work. Okay.
We knew that happy girlfriend was going to be a problem.
I guess so.
Okay, maybe you can get back to the slide.
We're going to do cake now. We're going to do cake.
Yes.
All right. There's cake. That's a piece of cake. This is another version of the same idea. So let's go right to here. Why is that man going after the cake? Okay, because here's one goal. Here's another goal. This goal is worth more. He's going after the cake because it seems that it's worth more than future imagined happiness. Here's the future imagined happiness. You asked about delusion. Where does the delusion come from? I think it comes from this. It's called delayed discounting because the future is actually discounted, like, 50% off, because it's in the future. The immediate thing, now the piece of cake, is the one that is right coming up in 5 minutes. And so the dopamine curve, the blue curve here, the value is increasing here toward the cake, and that's what he has his mind on, the immediate reward, not the long-term reward. The long-term reward is registering down here, that blue line, because you see that blue curve, that dotted line? It's only there at that point in time. It hasn't gotten close yet, so it's still value low, but the cake is value high. I think that's the essence of a delusion.
So this is from the point of view of craving.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. This is exactly what craving is about.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Crave, but shujik, but chakwa, sewa, shukshubu, shukshubu, shay. Yan di puja rengu di kaso di lue dang.
So Solinus is wondering whether craving should necessarily lead to this kind of delayed discounting. Because someone could have a strong craving, but at the same time not forget the future happiness.
Well, this is exactly the issue. Mm-hmm. This is what we have to focus on. If we can answer that question, then we can help to resolve the problem of addiction.
That's a long term 직다조래 vision 여댕에 야 그도 그도 crave 여덟인 거야.
그래, 다 단대스 거, 다 인자, 다 디 craving 여바 간식질이야, craving 쉬고 람삼 마주 보지지. 다르도 그 포기 때도 삼당 토야, 다 답시했다 가려놨어. 다디 So Solanus is making the point that there could be individuals who, while retaining the vision of their long-term happiness, mm-hmm. you know, still experience craving,
yeah,
but not run after it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, we talk about cognitive control and stuff like that, impulse control. But it's really very complicated because how much control do you have? And control is not stable over time, too. Control also mm-hmm. goes down in time. So it depends sometimes how long you have to wait. Mm-hmm.
But generalized lot of iron, case man some.
So Solin is making the point that it might really vary from individual to individual.
Yes.
Yeah. Even animal.
So, for example, in the animal world, you can see some animals who are wary of a trap.
Right.
And they are tempted to reach out. Oh. They are hungry.
It's good.
But yeah. some animals...
So, crave there.
The craving is there. Oh. They are able to resist.
Oh.
The virtue of restraint.
Oh. Yeah.
The virtue of restraint.
So they're thinking about the long-term consequence.
Yeah, but these individual differences is not just one person and another person, another person. Mm. The differences change in time. Mm. As you become more addicted, you become more of the type of person for whom that is very difficult. Right?
Mm-hmm. That's true, too.
And okay. even the animal who's wary of the trap has had some experience of the trap.
That's right.
It's not necessarily in the genes. It's learned something. Some people...
That's a true experience.
Yeah.
So we human beings also, you see. True experience.
Yeah. We learn. Yeah.
That's right.
Mainly, because experience.
So mainly, for example, any kind of conviction that you have often comes from a experience.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of alcoholics get better without any treatment because one day they say... Okay, this is really bad. This is wrecking my life. I'm going to stop. Well, that's like the animal who learned about the trap and learned how to be wary. Mm. So there is learning.
Right.
Yeah.
So, it's learning in both ways.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe you can say something more about that. I mean, you can learn from positive feedback. You can learn from negative feedback. You know, addiction is actually a learned behavior. As you say, it's developmental.
Yes. You're learning both ways. A part of you, the more primitive part, is learning something very stupid and simple. This is what I want. This makes me feel better. That's all. Another part of you is learning, this is bad for me. I need to find a way, a strategy to be smart. So very different kinds of learning at the same time, maybe. Yeah, because dopamine is tuned to the cake. Okay, so another just example. So now is worth more than later. Now seems extremely valuable than much more valuable than later. This is the grip of the immediate goal. Here, the immediate goal is snorting cocaine. Again, I don't know why I got into the happy wife, happy girlfriend thing, but that's the one possible future. But this is stronger now because it's present, not future. Okay, enough of that. The last part, how is it?
Okay. Happy marriage. And also, is a source as a preparation for happy divorce.
Yeah, that's true. It could happen that way, yes. It did for me. Okay. Okay, so now more about how do we deal with the problem? How can addicts learn to say no? And how can they trust themselves to carry through after so many failures? Mm-hmm. This is a big problem. Mm-hmm. So after you've failed 10 times, 50 times, 100 times, mm-hmm. how can you believe that you will ever succeed? It's a really big problem. And if they cannot trust themselves, so I say, well, I'm going to stop this for sure this week. I'm going to stop. But if you can't trust yourself, then who can you trust? Right? Well, they trust the drug or the drink. That's the only thing they can trust. And that's a real problem, because they get some relief for a while, but then they end up feeling worse. So it's another kind of betrayal. So the only thing you can trust is the thing you're addicted to, but the thing you're addicted to is wrecking your life or even killing you. This is why addicts are so miserable. They're really miserable.
Okay.
So, what is the solution? Tell us.
Use human intelligence. Common sense.
Okay,
I think.
It's hard.
I think education. And also it's the environment.
I think the environment is very important.
I think among the 10 people, 10 people, all 9 always drink. And then very difficult
for that one person
is restrain. Difficult. So everybody, too much sort of negative sort of emotion. Then someone, I think, difficult. So therefore, so we really need, through education, some kind of, because the mass movement, right?
Not a
massive movement.
No,
right?
Mass movement.
Oh, mass movement. And try to create healthy society, healthy family.
Mm. Yeah. That's the big solution, I think so too. But for the immediate now, we want to try to find a way to help addicts who are in big trouble, and logic and common sense are not working very well. So I just want to mention a couple of ideas that addicts have to find a different way of talking to themselves, a different kind of internal dialogue. You're always talking to yourself, having some dialogue, right? Okay. It could be a dialogue with the future self, kind of like we were saying before. So you say, okay, if I don't take any drink for the next 5-6 days, I'm going to be feeling much better. So future self says, just don't do it. Just watch a movie. Do something else instead. Go to a movie. Okay, future self, you're right. I'm wrong. I listen to you. It could be a real dialogue. And the future self says, good, just trust me, and do what I say. Okay, but it doesn't always work so well. Another kind of dialogue you could think of is with the higher self. And I don't know exactly what word you might want to use, but sometimes when people meditate or when they feel more confident or they have a bigger picture of the world or themselves, they have a better perspective. And so this could be a higher self, and maybe you could have a dialogue with that part. And the dialogue, the thing is, and here's another big problem, the dialogue, it can be friendly, like with the future self, but it could also be judgmental and accusatory. It can be nasty. And with addicts, very often this is the case, because some part, like a parent in your mind or something, or your teacher is saying, you're a lousy, rotten... You're a lousy, rotten addict. Okay? So what do you feel?
So someone is saying that maybe you need a combination of both.
Both some
mixture,
of this.
Yeah.
Do you understand? You then need cover that.
Right. So, but the judgmental and accusatory approach alone doesn't work at all.
No, it doesn't. But there may be some balance.
Anger, yung yasoro, hopelessness, yung yasoro.
It leads to anger, hopelessness, and so on.
Exactly. This is what I want to say. Yeah, it leads to anger.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
It's and this in the mind of the addict, these things are going on. You want me to stop? I'm a rotten person. I deserve to be miserable.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
they say, to hell with you anyway. I'm not going to listen to you. Go to hell.
That's right.
Okay, so these are different kinds of internal dialogues that maybe you could have. And I'm just going to end now in a minute. So my opinion is that somehow the internal dialogue, like any dialogue, it has to arrive at some agreement. And I think one word for that agreement is to say a feeling of self-trust, where you are telling yourself to stop, but you're also trusting that voice. Okay? And I just end by saying, I think that's what happened for me when I, the 200th time that I tried to quit, finally worked. Each time before that, when I said I'm going to stop, I usually said, well, I'll stop for at least 6 months. Or I'll stop, you know, except maybe, you know, when I'm out of town or on a holiday or something like that. And it was never, I could never believe it completely. But one time I said, I will never do this again. I hate this. It's killing me. It's not that I like it. I don't even like it. I hate it. And then I listen to that voice and trust that that sounds, I get it. You can do this. You can do this. And then people stop. And the days go by and you say, hey, I'm stopped. I'm stopped. Okay. So some kind of self-trust.
True.
Very important.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
So do you have a question that you wanted to ask His Holiness?
Yeah, I do. Well, these last few slides, the idea of some internal dialogue, that it can be more judgmental or it can be more compassionate. And I think it's very important that there must be some compassion in that. But my question to you, how do you get that there? Especially when people really hate themselves, they really feel disgust for themselves. How do you help them? How do you teach them to feel some compassion for themselves?
So he's also saying that initially, when he first heard the phrase self-hatred, hating oneself, it seems almost kind of paradoxical. You know, how can that be possible? But later, thinking more about it, even the fact that one may hate oneself must arise from a basic kind of underlying instinct where they care for themselves. And because you fall short of what you expect of yourself, then you hate.
Yeah.
So in deep inside, as a basis, you see self-centered attitude. Yeah.
So there is a kind
self-love
of love there. Self-love. Yeah.
Oh. So you want to be best something and fail. So then self-hatred comes. Even I know someone who really used to feel something very negative towards himself or herself. I think they also, you see, may sort of appreciate if someone, you see, sincerely showing genuine concern of their well-being. Then eventually, once, you see, they find someone, they can sort of, they develop full trust. Then I think some, kasoda, even a little harsh word. You see, then, you see, I think the other person, you see,
So then there will be a greater responsiveness to listen to others' more kind of, you know, harsher kind of, you know, words. So there's a Tibetan phrase which says that in the mouth of someone who cares for you, there may be harsh words.
So, Mark, maybe...
So, ultimately, you see, they must should let him develop trust. Otherwise, very difficult. So, ultimately, the important rule here again, love, compassion.
I think that's absolutely right. And in treatments for addiction, a lot of them involve a group. Mm-hmm. So you have a group of 10 or 20 people who care for each other, talk to each other. They listen to each other. Oh, you did that. Well, you know, I know what that feels like, and it's not the end. And that kind of talking can be very helpful. And Sarah is also going to talk to us about some treatment methods that use some compassion. I guess another question, which is really part of the same question, is a particular emotion involved in addiction more than any other emotion, and that is the emotion of shame, which by itself is incredibly painful. I mean, some emotions like anger is destructive, yes, but painful? No, not really. But shame is really, really painful. So when addicts have this huge amount of shame, you know, how almost nothing gets through.
So generally, kind of from the point of view of theory of ethics or morality in the Buddhist tradition, including the non-Buddhist Indian traditions, the ability to feel shame is considered to be an important moral quality, moral disposition. But here he's already saying that but when you use the word English word shame,
yeah.
There might be some complication because sometimes, for whatever
reason... And also guilty.
And guilt. Huh? So for whatever reason, sometimes when people talk about shame or guilt, there seems to be almost a sort of an absolutist connotation that somehow, you know, it's like irredeemable, irreparable.
Yeah.
So that is what probably makes the problem.
Yeah, North Americans are pretty... They're not very good with shame. They, right? They're afraid to use it in their parenting. And like you say about harsh words, you need harsh words sometimes when you're raising children. But this amount of shame, okay. This amount of shame, okay. When you have that amount of shame, you know, sometimes it's you know, toxic. It's like poison.
So, but in order for someone to be able to feel remorse, you do need the ability to feel shame.
At the beginning. Addicts start with that.
No.
They know what they're doing is...
So that this seems to suggest it's, again, a matter of proportion and also attitude towards it. Something like shame, if you relate to it as if it's irredeemable or, you know, irreparable, then your relationship to it is going to be more destructive.
I mean, His Holiness mentioned remorse. And I think that, you know, this would follow in the Buddhist context, the experience of shame, remorse, then follows vows, basically making a commitment not to repeat. But I'm wondering, from your point of view, Mark, what the role of remorse plays.
Yeah, that's a good question. It doesn't work very well because it can, but people who are serious addicts, most addicts, 80%, 70%, they get through it. They're okay. They're going to be okay. But there's 20 or 30% who may do really terrible things and feel terrible remorse, and it cuts off. It's like part of the personality dissociates and goes elsewhere. And you can't process it anymore. You just simply cannot process. I've done a horrible thing. I beat up my whatever, happy girlfriend. or whatever. It doesn't go anyplace after a while. So that in itself is probably not the answer.
Well, it comes then to the question of, you know, how does an addict apply an ethical perspective? Or is an ethical perspective at all useful for an addict in terms of shifting behaviors?
I think that's a really complex question. So, again, it sort of comes back to having some harsh words, but in the context of from compassion. well, ethics is a direction, right? It's a vector, it's a direction pointing in the right way, a way to be. If that can be done in a field in which there is some compassion and support, then yes, I think it can work. But addicts also have a real allergy to anything that has morality to it.
Oh, that's interesting. So even in, you know, like AA, it seems like there are ethical values within probably the biggest treatment program in the world, which is AA and all of its variants.
Yeah.
And that those values are shared within the context of the meetings, in the community process.
Right.
So I'm just curious then, you know, where the two questions that we're, you know, looking at right now, what is the view of ethics within that treatment protocol, and where does remorse stand, you know, when an addict or an alcoholic stands up and is transparent about, you know, having broken their commitment? Where does that stand in terms of that protocol?
So that's a good example. They do have a very strict protocol.
Remorse and ethics.
Right.
You know, within that particular treatment context, which is probably the biggest treatment modality.
This is Alcoholics Anonymous, AA?
NA.
I just explained to His Holiness. So you want to briefly explain how AA is structured?
It's been going on since the 1930s. And it's free, and groups of alcoholics or drug users will get together, maybe 10 to 20 to even 30 get together to talk, and they try to commit to stopping. They must stop, and they have 12 steps for doing this. And one of the steps is to realize, say, I'm helpless. I have no power over this. Well, there's a lot of argument about that, because, like you said, we might not want to be helpless, we may want to be cognitively helpful, powerful. And in fact, AA is not always so successful. But they do have a code, an ethical code. They try to make it work.
So when it comes to treatment, in terms of treatment and their efficacy, given that the tremendous diversity among people, you know, mental dispositions, inclinations, their background, and propensities, and so on, so you know, it would be quite difficult to really come up with something that would be somehow uniform
for a group.
Yeah,
that's certainly a problem. But they have the care on one side, and they do have these steps of behavior on the other side. And they take the idea of addiction and they put it out there. They say, your addiction is trying to get you. It's like an evil force. It's trying to get you. We have to be strong and keep it outside. And every day you have to concentrate, never have a drink, never have a drink, never have a drink. So this is an ethics, right?
So even in the case of of hopelessness, there could be many different types, some of which could be arising from the fact that you have lost complete trust or confidence in yourself, and your state of mind is so down. And then some form of hopelessness may be stemming from actually much more aggressive state of mind, like anger or hatred. So His Holiness feels that there could be different kinds.
So, hopeless.
So on the surface, it may seem like the same thing.
Yeah.
But the underlying them might be many different kind of mental processes, quite different from each other.
Yeah, I think
that.
So in order to be to develop an effective treatment, you need to be able to take into account these differences and the kind of uniqueness of the different situation.
Right. So some people would treat addiction one-to-one. A therapist and a person in some psychotherapy, one-to-one. And that might be useful because then you really learn about that person's problem. Other approaches are by group, but there are many different group approaches. And Sarah Bowen will talk about an approach that uses mindfulness as well as group support together, which I think is quite powerful.
You know, another question I'd like to ask you and also address this to Richie and Kent is, do you think that knowing how the brain operates in the process of addiction is useful for a person who's addicted? Is that helpful? What do you think?
I think it can be very helpful. People struggling with addiction who bought my book, read my book, I got a lot of email and letters saying, this has really helped me, and I was surprised by that. I didn't think it would help. I wasn't supposed to be a self-help book. But they said, now I understand why the feelings of craving are so powerful, so recursive, keep coming back, and why it's so difficult. And there's other things about psychological mechanisms, ego depletion and stuff, ego fatigue, and
maybe you would define ego depletion or ego fatigue for us.
The day Kanga Union Soli 11, Dothan Toshim and Pendoyorio Maris, the Kurang Landi, Kurang Mampuja Yigosons, depend on those chinsigdos.
The main thing is people say, okay, now I get it better. I understand this is a physical process in my brain, in my body. It's not just that I'm a bad person or a weak person. These are physical things going on in my brain. Okay, that helps. That really helps me understand it. And it really, I think it has helped some people to recover.
So how, you know, and then Richie, yeah.
If I can add just one thing. The process of addiction is predicated on the brain being plastic. The brain changes in response to the experience of addiction. But knowing that the brain is plastic, it can also change for the better. And so understanding the dual roles of plasticity can be helpful in promoting some hope for a positive transformation.
I agree. The neuroplasticity is a very useful concept for people thinking, will I ever change? Can I ever stop?
I mean, this is what becomes interesting then from this perspective is, you know, how you educate people before they enter into the cycle of addiction. Yeah. Kent, what's your perspective?
Neuroscientists and psychologists of addiction live in hope that understanding the nature of the craving process will give rise to better solutions for dealing with that process. Today, perhaps all it gives is insight and maybe helps inform accounts such as Mark's, but perhaps in the future, with better knowledge of the process, we can and you can develop better ways of dealing with the craving. Today, we owe Mark a debt of gratitude, I think, for illustrating how compulsive this kind of mechanism can become. Such a vivid account.
Thank you. Thanks. Anything you'd like to add on that?
Not really.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, I think one of the things, it's an interesting threshold that, where does knowing how the brain operates, how is that going to affect our capacity to actually transform our behavioral patterns?
One more thing. We can think about neurally inspired behavioral interventions. That is, interventions which are based upon our knowledge of the brain so that we can actually target specific kinds of training to particular particular components of the addiction process. So if we can understand through neuroscientific evidence which particular components of the cycle that Mark illustrated may be most problematic, perhaps training procedures can be developed that specifically target those circuits. One of the really interesting ironies in this whole realm in neuroscience is that we can actually produce a more specific change in the brain through behavioral methods than we can through any pharmacological method that we now have available. And so we can actually develop specific kinds of training that are targeted to specific brain systems.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And
Richie, can you repeat the last point, the contrast between the pharmacological
versus
the behavioral?
So taking a drug...
By citing an example.
Well, when you... the drugs that we know that affect the mind, they're blunt instruments. That's because they affect chemicals that course through many different parts of the brain, because these chemical systems are systems that are not just found in a specific location, but are found in a very distributed way. And so that's why when we take these drugs, when people take these drugs, there are side effects. But you can target in a very specific way through behavioral training circuits and produce a more specific effect in the brain than can ever be produced by taking a drug.
So I'm still not very clear. Specific behavioral interventions, like what?
Yeah.
So, for example, in the area of attention, there are drugs that are available for individuals with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Those drugs affect widely distributed systems in the brain, and there's a little bit of evidence to suggest. In fact, there was a very important paper just very recently published within the last couple of weeks in a major journal in Nature by a neuroscientist at the University of California, San Francisco, showing that certain kinds of video games that were specifically designed to train attention can actually produce more specific changes in the brain than are produced by taking methylphenidate, which is a stimulant drug that's used to treat individuals with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So that's a specific example.
So, yes, Mark, if you could go back to the cake slide.
Yeah.
So there you compared a particular moment where the craving for the cake is stronger than the blue line below, that is considering the benefit of the long-term happiness. So, and you say the craving for that is stronger. So, but I think you agree that what you are comparing are different natures. You are not comparing two cravings. The first one is clearly deluded because it expects much more than what it will deliver. That is a temporary, ephemeral sort of pleasure followed by shame, disappointment, disenchantment, and so forth. So we are comparing not with another kind of craving that is deluded, but possibly with the part of flourishing through other means that will give rise to a life of fulfillment. So first, maybe the intensity of the motivation incentive will be different, but you're also comparing things of two different natures, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. No, I don't agree. I think that's not the case. You're putting the effect before the cause. The reason it's diluted is because of the curve. Otherwise, the delusion is built into the curve. That's the only reason why it's delusional. It might be just as delusional to want to be slim in, you know, 6 months or something. But the point is that the delusional nature, the unreality of it, is a function of the way the brain focuses attention and desire.
So if I may add something about the blue that is still there somewhere, that in your mind is more valuable, but you may still have that long-term perspective that you sacrifice.
Yeah.
So the cake started with the image. You know, you have a chocolate cake right in front of me. That image is very strong.
Yeah.
Okay. So I get caught up in that curve and I forget the indigestion, the taking weight, and there's something more valuable possibly than eating chocolate cakes. But, you know, I may use the fact that there is still some perception of that long-term goal and then turn my mind to the state of inner peace, of inner satisfaction that this state will bring. And suddenly my trigger, my image will be changed. I could lift my gaze and look at the Buddha, mm-hmm. and that inspired me peace, compassion, and suddenly the chocolate cake is gone.
Right.
So in that way, even if it's weaker at that time, you could still use that to refocus your mind and help that grow in your mind so that you are no more deluded by this chocolate cake. That may seem then anecdotal once you got back to the bigger picture.
I agree with that. That's because, yes, you can focus on the long-term goal by adjusting your attention and looking above the short-term, so to speak.
But even now, I mean, if you picture that inner peace to be free from that kind of strong craving, that freedom also has a quality that you can appreciate if your mind is focused on it.
Yes, but it doesn't have to do with cake. You're French. You know the value of cake. It's not delusional. Cake can be a beautiful thing. It's about where these things exist in time and how the mind perceives.
You know, Mathieu, I mean, I think if you back down out of addiction into craving, I mean, if it's addiction, it's more difficult probably to break that cycle, but it's easier to intervene at the level of craving. You know, it's like once the horse is out of the barn, so to speak, you're, in a way, you're kind of sunk. It's the chocolate cake or die. But, you know, where I'm interested in is not just the so-called pathology or the, you know, issue of addiction, mm-hmm. but since craving is probably more pervasive than addiction, is how to intervene at the point of craving to transform that craving out of a delusional system into something where there's a realistic appraisal mm-hmm. of outcomes, cause and effect, and so forth. So, you know, you gave an example of that, which is to actually shift the locus of your or focus of your attention, which is a really good example. It's like, you know, you're looking at the chocolate cake, but you raise your eyes to the Buddha, for example, or you do something equivalent to that.
Yeah.
I wonder if there are other processes that you or Richie or others might engage in that actually break the craving. I mean, craving is, you know, that's something probably all of us suffer from to greater or lesser degrees. But, you know, it's like it's that level also I think we need to address, not just addiction.
Yeah, I think one other issue which we haven't explored yet is the issue of awareness. Craving can arise in the absence of awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And when craving arises in the absence of awareness, it can actually cause behavioral changes that are habitual and automatic. And if we can bring awareness to the point at which craving arises, it at least affords the possibility of greater freedom and control. And we can intervene before the automatic craving actually produces its effect. And so I think that one of the critical components of contemplative training may be the issue of awareness, mm-hmm. and awareness of internal signals that may be non-conscious but potentially rendered conscious through training.
Yeah, wonderful. Arthur.
First of all, thank you very much, Mark. I'd like to kind of go back to the couple of remarks you made. First of all, I don't think it's a mistake to have the happy girlfriend motif. I say that not just to be humorous, but actually I was thinking of your own situation with regards to your parents, mm-hmm. and the importance of a loving, supportive mm-hmm. environment. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading, I think it's saying you're hearing about another study with regards to Vietnam vets. When in Vietnam, 20 or 30% of the Vietnam vets were addicts. Mm-hmm. They came home, and I think 5 or 6% stayed addicts, and the rest basically did like the mice. You know, they were in a better environment with wood shavings and friends, and they managed to change. And so what I'm wondering, going back to the, in some sense, to the origins of that impulse, which somehow is a positive impulse, an impulse to be loved, mm-hmm. to be cared for.
It is a pretty foundational, valued goal.
It's a valued goal, and so there it is as a child or as an adolescent, and it's taken from you. Or it's in jeopardy, or at yeah. least you perceive it that way.
Yeah.
And so, in some ways, this is a kind of substitute or counterfeit. I mean, at least mm-hmm. I don't know how to say it. I'm just asking this question. So you could say the longing, which is delusory, mm-hmm. is satisfied by a delusory substitute.
Yeah.
You know, is it rooted in what's it rooted in? What is it that's in some sense, the positive virtue, the thing that is actually human.
That.
Towards which one, all of us would aspire, and which in the case of the addict, let's say, gets diverted, captured,
right.
and a substitute is put in place, a counterfeit.
Yeah, yeah, I think
Mark, can you, wait a second, So what's your response?
Yes, my choice of a happy girlfriend or wife was probably not arbitrary. I've always felt quite at peace when I'm in a peaceful interpersonal relationship. That's been, you know, one of my ideals. And I was showing His Holiness this book, which I just happened to be carrying around. It's called Drinking a Love Story. It's an excellent book. It came out about 10 years ago. And it's written by an alcoholic woman, and it's beautifully written. It's beautifully written. Yeah, yeah, it's just wonderful. Well, she calls drinking a love story, and this is not an accident. She is in love with alcohol. It is soothing her, it is relaxing her, it's taking care of her, it's structuring her, it's directing her, it's helping her. It's doing many of the things that a loving parent can do, should do. And I think that's a really important perspective on addiction. Many times the addictive substance is taking care of you in a way that you would have liked to have been taken care of by someone, by a person.
And in the short term, it produces a state of consciousness which feels almost non-dual, very connected
yeah.
or smooth or free of suffering.
That's right. These drugs are, you know, pretty well developed. Mm-hmm. They do a good job of what they do.
Mm-hmm. And yet we recognize, some aspect of us recognize that this is a substitute or counterfeit
yeah.
for something which would be more genuinely interpersonal or between two people.
We recognize it sometimes at certain stages, right? But
right.
you can fall into alcoholism, it's fairly easy because people drink socially all the time, and you know, it's kind of before you know it, after a while, and then you're already in a process of some denial, and then a little more denial, and then that denial becomes part of your rationalization, just thinking, no, well, that's not a problem. Yeah, I drink a lot, sure, but a lot of people do. And so when you say you realize that it's a substitute, that realization is not always available.
Yeah.
It often comes at a certain stage.
At which point shame starts to come in.
Yeah.
And then the question of whether there is a loving presence who, in some sense, is infinitely forgiving. And I was going to ask you about the role of forgiveness. I mean, shame, and if I think each one of us has something about which we are ashamed, and perhaps even repetitively.
I think that's a great point.
You know, and then, you know, in my own consciousness of thinking about these things, do I forgive myself?
Mm-hmm.
And it comes back to that almost like higher self you were speaking of. Is there such a place from which I can be forgiven in myself?
Yes. And one manifestation of that is the hug. You know, that to me, that's the that's the antidote for shame. But when I've got 2 7-year-olds that I'm raising, my boys, when they feel shame, a lot of too much shame, I just hug them. I just hug them because they feel better right away.
Better.
It's because it is the manifestation of that. Here is a place from which you are seen to be fine, deserving, of love.
So, Arthur, I think your point is really important, that the use of these substances, including addiction to technology, drug, sex, rock and roll, whatever it happens to be, is a kind of counterfeit. And what we're really seeking is connection. We're seeking love. We're seeking to actualize this, the part of our nature, the part of our mind, which is, you know, based in goodness.
Yeah.
And our suffering drives us toward these behaviors, which are lead us to fundamental disconnect. I mean, addicts are very disconnected.
Yes.
Whether it's sex or technology or whatever it is that you're addicted to or substances. So that longing for connection, for oneness, is really a fundamental, you know, human capacity that wants to be realized. So I just would like to go back to your work in education, because I think this is important. It's like, how do you create the context within the learning experience, also within the family setting, that avert behaviors which cause so much destruction for the individuals and communities and really environmentally, as you were describing it? Could you say something about that, Richie? What you've learned from...
Well, what we've learned is several things. First, we've been working with groups in public school settings from very adverse circumstances who have very difficult family lives, and we've actually, in many of the schools that we're working within, for example, 70% of the families qualify for food stamps. It actually has been challenging to incorporate the family into the things that we're doing, but we have gotten reports from the family members that the experiences that their children are having are actually having beneficial impact at home, because the kids are actually able, in certain cases, to experience when challenging emotions and destructive emotions begin to arise, and before they then act in ways which would be quite negative in their consequences, they want to go, they do various things to calm themselves. So, and this is in 5-year-olds. They're able to incorporate this. And, of course, there's a lot of variability in the extent to which children really incorporate this in their daily lives. But some do and actually bring it into their home life in ways that have beneficial impact on their homes. I think that Ideally, it would be best if we can incorporate the whole family system and do this in a more integrated way. And eventually, I think we'll be able to do that. And the initiative at Mind and Life in this area will incorporate the family as well as the child. So I think that this is clearly something to work toward.
Thanks. Diana.
So a couple of things come to mind apropos of many comments, Arthur's. And Mark, thank you for your really wonderful presence.
Thank you.
Not just presentation, but presence.
Thank you.
So you mentioned AA, and I agree with you. And part of some of my studies involved looking at AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, this self-help group that has been ubiquitous and has had a very big impact. It's one of the predominant treatment programs other than the medical ones that exist. And there are problems with it, there's no question. So the first of these 12 steps, the first one is, I admit that I'm powerless over this, I don't have the exact words, but over this illness, and I give myself up to a higher order. I give myself over to a God. And so for some people, you've talked to Your Holiness a lot about how many of the world's people now are not believers, so that eliminates a large number of people. But there's some people who have been tremendously helped by this. So a number of people have been helped by this program, and there are elements of it, I think, that are more universal. If you set aside this requirement that you turn yourself over to God. So one thing is, and you mentioned this earlier, Your Holiness, that it creates a whole new social environment. So you have been in this world of people who are drinking, and everywhere you turn, as you said, there are 10 people and 9 of them are drinking and you're the only one who's abstaining. That's very difficult to sustain. So you join this other social world, this world of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's anonymous. Everyone calls each other by their first names. They tell their personal stories in great detail, as we've heard Mark do. There's a great trust involved in doing that. I'll tell you my story, and others will encourage them and thank them for doing that. So there's a kind of a social connection there. There are meetings available almost everywhere. If you go to conferences and all over the world, you see a little notation on the program that at 5 o'clock you can go to the meeting of the Friends of Bill W., I think who was the founder of this. That's their code. And so you can slip off to this meeting wherever you are. And so that's one piece, this totally different social context. A second one is, part of what you do in these 12 steps is you make an inventory of the people you have harmed. You sit down and... So you sit down and you spend, and it's step by step, so you can't do that until you become sober. But as you become sober, you make this sincere, deep inventory of how has my behavior harmed other people. And that's really, I think, deals with this shame issue. And then you make amends. So there's a commitment to try to make amends to those people that you've harmed. So that's a second element. A third element is everyone has a sponsor, someone who looks after, especially if you're new to the program. So someone who's been in the program, who takes you on and says, okay, Joan, I'm with you, I'm your sponsor, call me up anytime, night or day, when this craving starts building in your brain, no matter where you are or I am, I'll get up in the middle of the night and I will come and I will talk to you until you get past it. That helps both the new person and the recovering person, because now you're helping other people. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's a part of the recovery process too. So there's lots, I think, in it to learn from, even though the whole package may not work for all people. The other thing I just wanted to say, it's unrelated to this, but the other day I went to a film that was showing in my hometown in Brookline, Massachusetts, that was a film about Richie's work, and it's called Free Your Mind.
Free the Mind,
I'm sorry. And it was made by filmmakers from New...
D-
Denmark.
Denmark, from Denmark. And it was quite, it's very beautiful and sweet, and we should all watch it at some point. But there's a moment to this issue about your question, Roshi, about does it help people to understand how their minds work. There was this very young boy who was struggling mightily. What, he was in fourth grade or something? He was...
It was preschool,
and he was terrified of many things. He had a difficult childhood. Correct me if I get that. And he was afraid to go on the elevator, and that was embarrassing and shameful for him because in the school building you had to go up the elevator. And so they gave him a little glass globe with colored particles in it. Have you ever seen one of these that you shake it? A snow globe? A glass globe. And they told him, when you get very upset, your mind is all confused. It's just like this globe. And they gave him the globe. And they said, if you're frightened, shake the globe and watch it. And pretty soon, all those particles will settle. And the globe won't be filled with particles. And it will be calm. And you can do that, too. That's how your mind can become calm. And he, as you watch this story, and you can, he finally was able to overcome this fear because he had this mental image of what was happening to his own mind and his emotions. And it was very touching.
So what we see here is that there was...
Absolutely, yes.
What we see in this story was that the child has a particular
construct,
and that was the absolute. So once the child was able to see that it could change, it could settle down, that solidity became dismantled.
Mm-hmm. He would hold this object with him just to remind him.
You know, about the difficulty of the first step, saying I'm powerless, I have to refer to higher authority. I think if we were to look in Buddhist context, we'd say, yes, now... My faculty to fight that is small, but to recognize that, acknowledge that we have the potential for change, and to be convinced of that, and it may take some time, but in the right direction I can do that, and that prevents also the problem of guilt. That means I am bad, I'm intrinsically bad, that's how I am, it's graven in stone and nothing can change. And so that then the shame becomes guilt in the sense of I'm fundamentally bad. So if you recognize the potential for change, yes, I've made mistakes, there are causes and conditions and environment and many things, but the potential is there, and then you can see that even now you feel sort of powerless. So it could replace that. Or neuroplasticity, if you want to use a scientific term.
So as somebody who's been through it, do these perspectives make sense to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just thinking about everything that's being said. Is this like sort of a...
When you're caught in the cycle of addiction, in that more extreme form, are you able to really appraise things realistically in the way that Mathieu is suggesting?
No, I mean, the solidity of the thing is the problem. It becomes a stricture. It becomes... rigid and leaves no room for alternative action. And so what was said earlier about the loss of free will, I think it makes a lot of sense.
So where does choice function in here? Because I know that's a theme for you.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess we're getting close to the end of our time, mention that there are two or three major approaches to addiction. At one extreme is the model that addiction is a disease, you know, because it changes the brain and in ways that are disease-like. At the other end is the choice model, which is that you're making a choice. It might be a bad choice, it might be a stupid choice, but it's still a choice. Okay, and somewhere else there is the idea of self-medication, that you're taking something you need to feel better because you feel crappy. So that's the third approach. What I'm hoping to get also from this week is Your Holiness's perspective and other people's about, because craving is so important in Buddhism and it's so important in addiction, how do we then see addiction as branching finally listening to my voice, branching out from normal development, a branch, a nasty branch, but still a branch from normal development. It is a way that the personality configures itself, just like other personalities configure themselves in other ways, because craving is common to all of us.
그런데 내가 들으셨다는데 노조부 따단 제베나 따당 리카시티 그다 진행곰 그리디기 나절 이제 나절 된데 조답 제기 시고 다 초질이야 다디 그다 진행 뭐 라쇼진 제목어 제제 두 침을 쓴 로단 신이어스 르데네 남베 나로야 세베 고디 숙심부시 숭고유드가라 세바데 케지무 찍어로다 세바데 직동에 계약 시제 된다 알고 군주 에딕션도 나로 세바데 계신부시 위인자다 나무단 체리니 돌랭게 토네 양직 세버디 미규만 참말 여러와 랑지수 용대 진자다 디토네 에디션 람가 만도야 탑람으로 붙이 삼단다 사버 신예메로 탱도 스달은 디다 돌랭 디토네 니마 가시시는가
그 되게 아주 공감 되시고 되게 awareness에서
no yeah so Rajiv talked about the important role of awareness
들으면서 왜
소소
어 I think that's the key thing.
Key fact, no.
Oh. Other. Any emotion. Emotion. This has a in the sense, some kind of strong sort of. The feeling. Sort of
feeling, no.
Oh. So there are two kinds of emotion. One constructive, one destructive. Generally, I feel those emotions, which now for example, strong sort of the empathy, sense of sort of concern of others' well-being, and when you see other sort of
suffering,
the suffering or difficulties, even tear. So there is a strong emotion there, but such. Emotions usually is very much related with awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, such sort of emotion, such strong sense of concern of others' well-being and emotional level only come through training. Training means through awareness and familiarize. Then craving. You see, these spontaneous sort of emotion.
It's more instinctual. Yeah.
Most of these are destructive, very much related with ignorance. So that took us to ignorance. And that did save us in Nangbe Shung and Mongu Shung Yore, that the Chad.
So you're right that in the Buddhist sources, there's a lot of discussion about craving. And, craving is also seen as the root of unenlightened existence. But on the other hand, if you dig deeper, then underlying craving is this delusion. And ignorance, so which is really seen as the kind of the more fundamental kind of root. So sort of beyond craving, there is kind of underlying craving is a form of ignorance or distortion. So you showed the tanka, the depiction of the wheel of life. The first in that chain is ignorance. So the understanding is that if we are not able to intervene at that stage and tackle the problem of ignorance and delusion, then the rest of them in the chain is going to follow.
So ignorance le ni dwa da ta ada nga zo tsa di ta ga da yunje lo ngwa de gone yunje lo mo be mo ri sa ti ga li go ta.
So then in the Buddhist sources we speak of ignorance, even ignorance at two different levels. One is ignorance pertaining to the cause and effect dynamics. This is what we are talking about here. And then the underlying this is a deeper ignorance, which is the ignorance pertaining to the ultimate nature of reality.
So, because awareness is that.
So if we're able to bring greater awareness, mm-hmm. particularly of the causal dynamics, mm-hmm. then we become more aware of the consequences of a particular type of behavior and pattern. Mm-hmm. And then on that basis, we can exercise the restraint. Mm-hmm. But even then, to be able to exercise restraint and apply it, it does require other factors as well.
Mm-hmm. So with addiction, the craving, addiction is about wanting to reproduce a state over and over again, which is ignorant because we are impermanent, and wanting to be something that you're not, which is to feel a certain way, which you don't feel, and all these, would that be examples of the kind of ignorance that one has to
So the statement of the Buddha that the source of suffering is not knowing or ignorance. Is really a profound teaching.
Oh. Obviously, everybody do not want suffering. Mm-hmm. And yet, such sort of the problem, health problem, this problem, family problem, health problem, yeah. due to some addiction.
Yes.
These are because of the self, because of the creation.
Mm-hmm.
You do not want suffering, but a lot of suffering, your own creation. Why? Ignorance. And I think awareness also there are different degrees. Awareness, intellectual level, yes. If you do this, yes, the negative consequences come. But that alone not sufficient.
Mm.
The full sort of the conviction need. Full conviction then really because of the carry the action role.
Action role.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Your Holiness, thank you so much. Your reflections are really extraordinarily helpful for us as we begin to open or unpack the issue of craving and addiction. And Mark, I want to especially thank you for your transparency. It is very powerful to have somebody who was caught in this cycle and also who went through the experience of recovery. And, you know, all made a world that is benefiting others from your direct experience. So thank you so much.
Thank you.